leading British scholarly critic of Israel. He also co-founded and is a co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch. Our guest expert today is Sara Al-Waghfi, who is a UK-based Palestinian. She's a graphic designer and an activist. Sara has been centrally involved in the campaign to sabotage the activities of Friends of Roots in the UK with the Youth Front for Palestine. Welcome to the show. David, let me start with you. Where does Friends of Roots fit into the Zionist armoury? Is it linked to other groups that we've previously discussed in this programme?
Well, yes, it is. I mean, there are a whole range of different groups which pose as being sort of there to encourage dialogue and meaningful exchanges of information and ideas. And they're not really about promoting Israel at all. They're just about having dialogue. And it's very similar to some of the other organisations we've looked at in this programme, the Forum for the Discussion of Israel and Palestine, which we've looked at, Solutions Not Sides, which went into schools and was trying to propagandise school children, or Nisa Nashim, the women's organisation, which we exposed. We went to one of their meetings, I think, if you recall, exposed their actual pro-Zionist agenda. These are all organisations which are set up to mislead the people who are involved with them. And this organisation, Friends of Roots, is particularly egregious because it's not just about saying that Israel is a democracy like every other country and it's a very nice place and you really shouldn't be critical of Israel. It's also bringing settlers into the equation. And now, everybody knows under international law that settlers are illegal and they shouldn't be there. And yet this is there to try and humanise the settlers and present them as if they're just ordinary people who are looking for a life in the future. And that, of course, is completely unacceptable.
Mm. And Sara, I mean, what do you make of Friends of Roots in the UK?
From the YFP perspective, essentially, Friends of Roots is pushing the narrative of normalisation. They're pushing the idea that these dialogues that he's mentioned are essentially peace, related to peace and equality. But what they do is they generalize, they overwash, they honestly distract from the realities of Palestine and the daily struggles that Palestinians have to go through. So while we should be talking about more important things, what they do is that they pull us away as the youth and also anyone who's in the solidarity movement and create a false reality of dialogues that are misleading and divide our attention, frankly. So at the end of the day, this kind of organization seeks to divide the youth that reside in Manchester and London and across all of Britain. And the support is vast and large and it's big and we're proof of that.
Sure.
And I think a really important thing is that their reaction to our large support for the Palestinian movement in Manchester, they target us because of the mass that we have.
Yeah.
And it's a really important thing to make sure that we continue to understand how they function
in
across Britain.
No, indeed. I mean, David, what do we know about Stephen Longdon and Ruth Jacobs, who seem to be the people running Friends of Roots UK?
So these are people who are not well known, but they have both of them had roles with other normalisation organisations, with FODIP, the Forum for Discussion of Israel and Palestine, and with Solutions Not Sides, which is run by this organisation called One Voice, set up by this passionate Zionist. And one of them, in fact, has also been involved in a pro-Israel group, a Friends of Israel group. You know, it's pretty explicit. It says on the tin it's Friends of Israel group. So it's clear what's going on here. These are Zionist organisations presenting a front as if they're interested in dialogue or peace or finding a way to mutual understanding. There is no mutual understanding with the settlers. They must be removed and the land must be returned to the Palestinians. And that's the bottom line. There can be no dialogue about this.
Mm. Sara, I wonder if you could tell us how the Youth Front for Palestine heard about Friends of Roots and what did you find out about them?
Yeah, so it's interesting. We had already been looking into normalization as a organization. We were interested in understanding the different tactics used, but we actually came across the campaign through the British Muslim Heritage Center, and they had a leaflet advertising the event. And what's interesting about that is that we were having already been researching into it and trying to understand how these campaigns work. It kind of fell into our lap, and it seemed like the perfect time to initiate a campaign. So at that point, we began researching into the individuals involved, the organizations involved, and how and where our targets and focuses need to go. So, for instance, Afzal Khan, became a prime kind of focus for us. The British Museum Heritage Centre and Chorlton High School, which is where the two events would be held. What's great about the turnout is that we actually didn't even need to protest, and that goes to show how brittle and frankly baseless the kind of Friends of Roots mission is. Our lack of protesting in a physical way wasn't because we hadn't planned it. It's because we were able to move in mass and online. We were able to petition, send letters in, call into the British Muslim Heritage Center. We were able to move our, you know, group of people and have a focus on the normalization campaign and utilize what we understand about normalization against them, essentially.
Well, David, I mean, this guy, Schlesinger, says he's a passionate settler, yet the title of their recent attempted tour was Two Truths in One Land. I mean, what do you make of that?
Well, so this is a time-honoured settler-colonial way of explaining themselves. They want to say that they're just one set of people and that the other set of people who they've displaced and settled have their own truth as well. And really, we need to understand everybody's truth. And that's a way to have a settlement and to have some kind of dialogue and understanding between the two peoples. Well, no, on the contrary, there are not two peoples. There is one people which has been invaded, which has been settled, which has been occupied. And they're the ones that need to be removed. It's like saying if you were white settlers coming to North America, well, we're white settlers. We have our own background and culture, and which demands respect. Let's have a discussion between us and the Native Americans, and we'll see what kind of accommodation we can come to. No, not at all. What should be happening here is an understanding, which is that this is a brutal occupation and invasion by settler colonialists, and it has to be ended.
Sarah, I wonder if you could just explain how Friends of Roots is actually involved in this kind of normalisation process.
Yeah.
What's it doing?
Well, we've spoken a little bit about the dialogue, the dialogue sessions. What they do is they have an Israeli settler and a essentially token Palestinian come in and have a dialogue. And again, we've spoken about how it's a distraction, how these conversations are essentially disguised as peace and quality, but what they do is they diminish the truths of what's going on, and it changes the language. It's very interesting. Language is the most important thing about, and as for YFFP, we have a dictionary that we understand, and we try to inform ourselves and the local Manchester-like city, and language such as conflict, language such as oppression. We need to use what the real words are, right? It's not a conflict. It's an oppression, and understanding how language functions in these dialogues is something that they try to utilize against us. So a part of our job as YFFP members to combat, you know, Friends of Roots is to essentially make sure that we gather the youth and inform them as much as possible, especially on social media.
Well, we're just going to thank you for that. We're just going to pause there for a moment to watch this report now about the successful campaign by the Youth Front for Palestine against the Friends of Roots.
Friends of Roots tried to infiltrate the UK by taking its message of normalising settlement and ethnic cleansing on a speaking tour of the UK. They claimed that over 9 days they would start with a visit to the Scottish Parliament, then take in London, Luton, Cambridge, Oxford, Warwick, Birmingham, Huddersfield, Manchester, Salford and Trafford. Co-chair Stephen Longdon claimed that all are welcome to the meetings, but only 3 of the 20 events listed on their site were open to the public. Unsurprisingly, they've now deleted that webpage, though obviously Palestine Declassified tracked down a copy. In Luton, they spoke at Chalney High School for Boys, where they bragged that they took their bullying apologia for ethnic cleansing to a school where 80% of the student body is Muslim. They posted on Facebook that during the 5 days so far of our speaking tour in England, Nora and I have spoken to 4 Orthodox Jewish groups. After that, they posted no other news, because things went rapidly wrong for the tour. The only other events they were able to run were either private, online, or held with Zionist lobby groups such as one in Salford with the notorious Northwest Friends of Israel and the Jewish Representative Council of Manchester. Friends of Roots did not reckon with a newly active and politicized opposition, no doubt inspired by the fabulous victories of Palestine Action in recent years. New and more radical pro-Palestinian groups are emerging. It's no accident that Manchester is a key locus for this story. It is here that the Youth Front for Palestine has emerged. They say, "We are the youth of Manchester, the front lines, the voice of the streets, here to globalize Palestinian resistance and fight for free Palestine." They're taking the next step from solidarity towards support for the liberation of Palestine. On 8th of November, their campaign began to pay off. The event at Chorlton High School in Manchester was cancelled. The other Manchester event followed suit. Stalwart activists at the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign picked up the trail. Letters were written to members of the Scottish Parliament, call MSPs. Other Labour MSPs put pressure on the organiser of the meeting and cancelled it duly was. At Warwick University in Birmingham, campus police used violence against anti-Roots protesters on the 22nd of November. It seems even the whiff of protest forced organizers to move the event online. As part of the tour, the formal launch of Friends of Roots UK was to be hosted by Zionist apologist Alex Sobel MP and Afzal Khan MP at the Houses of Parliament. But the pressure proved too much, and the cherry on the cake was that Afzal Khan withdrew from the meeting. Victory to the YFFP and all the new groups emerging to pursue the liberation of Palestine.
David, the Friends of Roots group were planning quite an extensive tour of the country, weren't they?
They were. I mean, you can't tell that now if you look online because they've taken the page down from their website. But of course, we were able to find a copy. And they had about 20-odd meetings on there. But the interesting thing about it was that although they had lots of meetings, that they weren't public meetings. These were private meetings or invite-only meetings. Even the public meetings were ticketed. So there was a sense that they already knew that this was so controversial that they couldn't get away with public meetings. And of course, the YFFP made sure that the price for them was far too high. And they had to cancel virtually every meeting that they held in public. They can't appear a public meeting in this country unless they're in a pro-Zionist, a pro-Israel meeting scenario. So there's a real sense that they've taken this whole normalisation agenda a step too far and they've had to step right back. And we'll see what happens in the future, but it looks like there's a sense now that normalisation is starting to be a dirty word and it will be difficult for them to come back from this.
Mm. I mean, Sarah, I wonder whether you could say a little bit about your involvement with the YFP and how Friends of Roots were targeted.
Yeah, well, I work as the co-media. So what I do is create graphics, photograph, film parts of our demonstrations and protests. That's a big part of, like, telling our story and also informing the public that there's a live Manchester scene for the solidarity movement. How we mobilize and how we kind of create a campaign against Friends of Roots is not only just a virtual one on social media, but it was also in person. So we actually attended the British Muslim Heritage Center and we spoke with the executives. We sat down in a room. We shared our concerns. We also had lobbying with Afzal Khan, where we sent in our concerns as well. And we even went door to door. I mean, we're working on the streets and we're going home to home, providing leaflets on the dangers of normalization and what it even is. You mentioned that normalization, I wonder if people even know the word, some people who are not involved in this kind of activism. And I recently found out that normalization is a very normal word used in Palestine. People are very familiar with it there. But here, somehow, in a global stance, it's not. And we need to define what it is and how dangerous it is. So, we need to spread that word as much as we can, even saying it.
Well, it's great. I mean, great what you're doing in terms of raising public consciousness in distributing these leaflets to the wider public. But David, I mean, the Friends of Roots chair, as you know, claimed that the events were open to the public. But as you've just said, most of them were actually closed events. I mean, that's a contradiction, isn't it?
You say contradiction, I say lie. They were lying. They want to present themselves as being cuddly and friendly. Oh, we're open to the public. Come and have a discussion with us. It's a dialogue. There's no dialogue available. No. These are private events. It's a complete joke.
Sure. So, why is he saying then that it's a propaganda campaign?
You can't see the itinerary anymore on the web. But we have copies. We can get people copies if they want to. To write to us about it. But their own itinerary says private meeting, invite-only meeting, private meeting. Mm. So this is a propaganda campaign, and, of course, propagandists lie. And they lie to say that we are open, we're friendly, we believe in dialogue, we believe in discussion. These BDS people who want boycott, divestment, sanctions of Palestine, that's the wrong approach. We have to talk to everyone and come to a common agreement. No, we don't. There's no common agreement here. What has to happen is the end of the oppression of the Palestinians.
Mm, absolutely. Well, Sarah, I mean, as an activist with the YFP, I mean, tell us how you manage this feat. I mean, it's quite a feather in your cap, really, isn't it? I mean, I think what would be interesting is if you could sort of set out what the role of social media was in the campaign.
Absolutely. YFFP, the most, like, as a member, my favorite thing about it is that we are not singular people. We work as a community. Mm. We work together. We have committees. And none of it would work if it wasn't for our diversity and the shared experience of everybody else. So we all bring something to a plate. And that's the best thing about YFFP. We all are a part and active members. We choose to be there. We choose to educate ourselves. And that reflects on our social media. What we put out there is a reflection of how much time and effort we put into researching, informing ourselves, educating ourselves. And a feat like this was accomplished, frankly, by the absolute desire from all these activists in our community, not even just at YFFP. There are so many in Manchester-based ones, PAL Action, and they all motivate one another. And this feat wouldn't have been possible without the committees that push each other. To say the least, we were able to achieve it by using social media as a vehicle.
Sure.
Right? Like the internet, our social platforms, they are a global network of people.
Indeed.
And it's a way to educate everybody, even with just as something as simple as a hashtag.
You've not encountered any suppression then of your output on social media, because people like myself and David, for example, our sort of social media output is restricted.
Quite restricted. Yeah, no, we have not faced any restriction. A lot of the people who come to our page and follow us are people who are involved already, but also are eager to learn.
Sure.
We are small, but we are so mighty. Mm. And I think social media is a great platform, and it can turn and be
a great
suppressive.
Way of amplifying, certainly,
absolutely.
Isn't it? I think, sort of important messages like
absolutely.
This and way of kind of raising
Twitter
public,
storms,
public
boycotting.
Yeah.
You know, we had the Puma, we had Barclays,
sure.
and
yeah.
even going in physical spaces and putting that onto a virtual space can alter the perspective.
I mean, David, turn to you now. I mean, what should we make of all this? I mean, is this just another tried and failed normalisation gambit, or do you think there's more to it?
Well, normalisation is an ongoing element, a key element for the foreign strategy of the state of Israel.
Mm.
And they use it all over the world, in the Middle East, in the US and the UK and in other parts of Europe. It's a key part of the foreign policy strategies of Israel. And this particular example is a new step in the sense that it involves settlers.
Mm.
And that's a step I think they've taken too far, but it's a step they've taken too far which they have to take, because we now have a new Netanyahu government which is saying openly, we're going to expand the settlements. And that's the next step that the Zionists must take. They must take the step of trying to legitimate the settlements in a way which they haven't done before. And that, of course, is where they're going to fail. And so it's tried and failed normalization, but it's also the beginning, I think, of the end of normalization, because we've seen these clear defeats for them, and we will see, I think, in the future, many more defeats for them. This is part of the turning of the tide against Zionism, not just in Palestine, but all around the world.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's certainly encouraging to hear. But, Sarah, finally, looking forward as a young Palestinian activist, I wonder if you could just sum up where you think we are with this kind of campaigning.
Yeah, this kind of campaigning, especially the BDS, I mean, campaigning, I think it's strong. I think that as much as the Israeli occupation continues to put out campaigns, we will continue to do the vice and the opposite. So as much as they output, we will do double. We're going to continue making sure to educate and spread this knowledge of what is going on, but what is truly lies. I mean, it's untold truths that are hidden by this like political justifiably political racist opinion. It's racism discarded, and it hides. And I think people can see that. Mm. I think people can see that. And I hope that as these campaigns continue, we can push forward in the narrative of like we need to work together. I think that's the predominant thing, and it seems to be working in YFFP, in PAL Action. We move in mass, and without each other, we wouldn't be able to do much. So,
well, we're going to have to leave it there again. Unfortunately, time is against us as usual. We probably need to have a longer show, but anyway, we're out of time today. I hope you found the program informative, and thanks to our guests, Sara Al-Waghfi, and, of course, our resident expert, Professor David Miller. And thank you for joining us today. We'll be back next week with more investigations and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So, until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. The results of the latest opinion polls in Britain show that the majority of the British people are dissatisfied with the performance of the country's healthcare system in the midst of a sharp drop in medical services and a widespread strike by physicians, nurses, and ambulance drivers. We take a look at some of the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Daily Mail has covered this story and tells us more. Senior official across the National Health Service has warned the wave of ongoing strikes by the UK health staff has made the workload more challenging as a new string of industrial action is yet to hit the country. The chief executive of NHS England, Amanda Pritchard, was at pains to confirm that the repetitive strike action by healthcare workers were clearly having an impact and heavily added to the burden on the NHS. She told BBC's Radio 4's Today programme on Saturday, 21st of January, she said, "It is clearly having an impact. I think that's obvious. My sense is that everybody is looking to try and reach a resolution. As the strike action is extended over long periods of time, and as those dates start coming closer together, it does get more challenging. There is absolutely no doubt about it." NHS England said thousands of NHS operations and appointments had to be cancelled in recent days as a result of the nurses' strike in England, while 27,800 bookings had to be rescheduled, including 5,000 operations and treatments. Number 10 Downing Street has admitted that the planned walkout would cause further disruption to patients. The National Health Service is bracing for its biggest industrial action ever next month, and it is expected thousands of operations and appointments will need to be cancelled over the next few months. Healthcare professionals have warned that emergency services are facing alarming levels of stress and that more hospital beds are desperately needed, as the healthcare system is facing a shortage of staff. Delayed discharge, bed shortages and a fresh wave of COVID-19 and flu infections and ongoing strikes are all among the most prominent pressures that the NHS is facing this winter. The dispute came after the staff demanded a pay increase were rejected by the government, which says it cannot afford high increases in pay that match the soaring inflation. And even if it could, such monetary increases would further fuel inflation. Speaking to broadcasters during a hospital visit earlier this week, Health Secretary Steve Barclay appeared to rule out a 10% pay rise for nurses, insisting it was not affordable. Steve Barclay said, "Well, 10% is not affordable. It would be an extra £3.6 billion a year. And obviously that would take money away from patient services, essential services that we need to invest in given the backlog from the pandemic." During the past months, the United Kingdom has been grappling with its biggest strike wave for decades, with airport baggage handlers, border staff, driving instructors, bus drivers and postal workers all walking off their jobs to demand higher pay. The British newspaper The Independent has also covered the same story and tells us more. Several leading healthcare officials have warned the situation in the United Kingdom's National Health Service is unbearable and would remain that way without any significant changes, as NHS trusts declare repetitive critical incidents inside the system. Referring to the shortage of staff, President of the Society for Acute Medicine, Tim Cooksley, warned recently that unless we're able to retain and then attract colleagues back and recruit new colleagues, then our situation will remain unbearable for a long time. Recent industrial actions by nurses and paramedics has added to the shortage of staff, causing serious patient delays, as flu and COVID-19 cases across the country are on a rising slope. Confirming the dire situation across the country's healthcare system, Matthew Taylor, the chief executive of NHS Confederation, said patient delays are being compounded by high rates of flu and COVID-19, as well as the aftershock of industrial action by medical staff last month. Matthew Taylor said the responsibility of the ongoing crisis on longer-term issues of more than 130,000 NHS vacancies and a decade-long lack of investment in capital and at elective backlog, which continues to grow past 7 million people. He added, "Health leaders have been telling us that the pressure their staff are facing are becoming unbearable. It seems likely that the next 3 months will be defined by further critical incidents." Portsmouth Hospital University Trust, which has been in critical incident status for almost a week, told patients recently that its hospitals and emergency departments are overfull. It urged patients not to attend a hospital without a life-threatening illness. Otherwise, they will be redirected to an urgent treatment center. The fresh chaos across the National Health Service comes in the wake of a serious warning by the Royal College of Emergency Medicine that up to 500 patients are dying each week due to emergency care delays. The Royal College of Emergency Medicine Vice President Ian Higginson blasted the system's defects and urged the NHS not to blame its shortcomings on the rise of flu or the rise of COVID-19. Bed occupancy remains particularly high across UK hospitals, with more than 9 in 10 beds filled. The number of free beds has been at its lowest for the past 10 years. The website of Business Times has also covered the same story and tells us more. Nurses across England have launched a new round of strikes over low pay in an already disrupted public healthcare service as inflation skyrockets. Before joining a picket line in central London, Nurse Anna Swift said, "We take strike action with a heavy, heavy heart, but a clear mind about what we want to achieve. It's time to take some action to say, we need better pay, we need better conditions." More strikes are said to be planned for February 6th and February 7th by the Royal College of Nursing Union, which may be unprecedented in Britain's history. The latest annual inflation figures released early on Wednesday, 18th of January, showed it remained close to an all-time high, with rates easing slightly in December to 10.5%, from 10.7% the previous month. The main union of nurses says the government has conducted no serious negotiations regarding the improvement of contracts in 2023. In December, nurses went on strike for the first time in more than a century, following a wave of industrial action by the public sector workers hit by a cost of living crisis due to rising prices. The Conservative Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has insisted recession-hit Britain cannot afford to reopen public sector pay already set for this fiscal year, which ends on March 31st. Britain's Health Minister Steve Barclay said unaffordable pay hikes will mean cutting patient care and stoking the inflation that would make us all poorer. He added, "Salary increases would take billions of pounds away from where we need to be." The strikes by nurses in England and Wales in December led to the cancellation of some 30,000 elective procedures and outpatient appointments. But Pat Cullen, head of the Royal College of Nursing, said nurses are the voice of the patient and has repeatedly urged the government to negotiate overpay to retain beleaguered staff and attract new recruits.
Insight. Welcome to Insight. On this episode, we will be discussing the destruction of Islam's holiest sites by the Saudi regime in a conversation with Dr. Irfan Al-Alawi. But first, this brief analysis.
How does one begin to understand the historical ignorance of the majority of Muslims regarding the destruction of the religious and historic heritage of Hijaz, the land of Prophet Muhammad, where the Holy Quran was revealed and Islam was established? How many people know that the contemporary kingdom of Saudi Arabia is built upon the ruins of Islam's holiest sites and their destruction at the hands of Wahhabi Takfiri armies led by Abdul Aziz ibn Saud, the founder and first king of Saudi Arabia, after his army's conquests of Mecca and Medina in the mid-1920s? Is it a coincidence that at the precise time when the British Empire is destroying the Ottoman Empire, American oil companies are beginning to exploit the massive crude oil reserves in eastern Arabia, and Western Zionists are salivating to establish a colonial Zionist settler state in Palestine, that at the same time, an army of illiterate Takfiri Wahhabi Bedouins conquers the heart of the Muslim world and pulverizes everything of religious and historical value and significance related to Prophet Muhammad, his pure family and companions, and the early history of Islam? How are we to understand the silence of so many Muslims when nearly 100 years later they witness the Najdi Bedouin Saudi conquerors of Hijaz turning Islam's heart and holiest cities into a concrete jungle filled with cheap imitations of Western high-rise hotels, the tower over the Holy Kaaba, and gaudy, ugly shopping malls dedicated to the gods of consumerism and gluttony? It's very likely that the incompetence and inability of many Muslim political leaders to create viable states and economies has made them completely dependent on the handouts of Saudi petrodollars for survival, and apparently has had a negative effect on their ability to learn contemporary history and use their tongues to protest the destruction of Islam's holiest sites, something that is happening right in front of their eyes. The moral impunity and legal immunity granted by the United States, Britain, and the Zionist-owned global media to the Saudi tribe is not limited to cases of killing, chopping up, and then dissolving the remains of a dissident journalist in acid, but apparently also extends to the systematic destruction of the history of Islam in Islam's two holiest cities of Mecca and Medina. How do we explain this savagery, this ignorance, this destruction, this silence, and this impunity?
Dr. Irfan Al-Alawi, thank you so much for joining us on Insight. I'm very glad we are able to have this conversation, Doctor. We had a recent interview with Dr. Ali Al-Ahmed, who talked about some of the crimes of the Ahl Saud as it related to the eastern provinces, the Shias, and other areas. And in that conversation, a very interesting issue came up, which I thought is very important that we follow up on and that we talk about, because it's an issue that really is hurting the soul of hundreds of millions of Muslims. And that's the issue of the destruction of the religious, cultural, and historic heritage of Hijaz. Hijaz being the region, of course, where Mecca and Medina are located, the heart of the Islamic world, the land of revelation, the place where Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and the companions and the Ahlul Bayt all originate from and lived. And this is something that you have been, this issue of the destruction is something that you have been talking about for 3 decades. You've been commenting about it, you've been documenting it, and raising your voice about it. And it's very interesting because in this process, we recently had a news item where the Ahl Saud were announcing that they want to turn it's ridiculous. It's comical. I mean, it's tragic, but you know, sometimes tragedy and comedy are very close. That they want to turn Mecca Medina into a financial hub, into a area of increased business, and a location for increased global business. So, if you could please give us your insight, give us a little bit, introduce us into this subject of the destruction that is being done by the Ahl Saud to the religious and the cultural heritage of Hijaz and Mecca and Medina.
First of all, alhamdulillah, Rabbil Alameen, wa salatu wa salamu ala ashraf al-anbiya wa mursalin wa sayyidina wa mawlana Muhammad wa ala alihi wa sahbihi wa ahli baytihi. I'm delighted to be part of Insight program and to give the sad destruction of Islamic heritage within Hijaz. I do not like to call it Saudi Arabia, because Saudi Arabia is a bid'ah itself, named after the founder. So let's stick to the traditional word, which is Al-Hijaz, as it was known. They have destroyed and wiped off everything what belongs to the Prophet ﷺ, the Ahlul Bayt, and then, of course, some of the other historical sites, such as Christian churches, which have been there since the Ottoman period. I'll give you an example. Some 30-plus years, the Hadis or Salafis, have been them as a machine is drilled to demolish anything and everything which is the location, site, not only of the Prophet ﷺ, Ahlul Bayt, companion, but even his parents. So Sayyida Amina, the mother of the Prophet ﷺ, is buried in Abwa, which is a couple of hours' drive from Medina al-Munawwarah. And the pilgrims used to go and visit this site. It's an isolated area within it's a desert princess on top of a mountain where the Prophet had accompanied her to the sacred journey to visit his blessed father. And I would come to his father's grave a bit later on. What the Wahhabis did 30-plus years ago is they came and actually bulldozed the remains of the grave of Sayyida Amina. Not only did they bulldoze it, they put kerosene over the grave, burnt it, and then shattered some broken glass all over that particular location. The pilgrims were not able to attend this historical site. And then, on top of that, they put a matawa office, or the religious police, at the bottom of this hill or mountain, harass pilgrims who visit holy site. It's quite sad to hear that when Muslims are so asleep in over the past 300 plus years, that we do not have any reaction of this. Yet we are very quick to react when something happens in Al-Quds Sharif, that they are removing a brick, Al-Aqsa or Bayt al-Maqdis, but no one reacted to the bulldozing of the blessed mother of the Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam. Let me emphasize that as a Muslim, this is not a Shia issue. It is a global issue.
Exactly.
And it concerns every single human being who is passionate about heritage. Otherwise, heritage becomes a legend. The difference between the Christians and the Muslims is very clear. As a historian, the Christians claim to have the cloak of Turin, which is, they claim that it was the cloak when Jesus was crucified.
Correct.
There is no evidence of that, although they still believe by that. What we have as Muslims is something much more beautiful and much more in perfection. We have the Sira al-Nabuwiya, the Sira of the Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam, is not engraved in the Hadith of the Prophet or in the Quran, the Mashab. It is engraved in the soil or the ground. An example is that when the Prophet accompanied his Blessed Mother at a very young age to Abwa, to go to Medina to visit his blood father, this location, the Prophet visited his mother, which fell ill and passed away at that location. So the Sira is embedded in that location.
Correct.
And then when the Prophet lived with Sayyida Khadija Umm al-Mu'mineen radiallahu anha in Makkah al-Mukarramah for so many years, and the Quran was revealed in that house when he was laying his blessed head in the lap of Umm al-Mu'mineen, Ya ayyuhal muzammin illa kalila. This is the seerah not only of the house, but embedded in that particular soil that sallallahu alayhi wa sallam lived. So if these locations are bulldozed, eventually wiped away, we do not have anything left of this location, but only words and texts. So what remains is a legend, and then we just say, oh, well, this is where the Prophet lived, and it's, but where's the proof? Where's the existence? It has been wiped away by digging up, dynamiting, and raising it completely without preserving it for generations to come. And that's a very sad fact. So the House of Saud caused this tremendous atrocity in Abwa. They didn't stop there. And then in the early 1970s, they expanded the Prophet's mosque as for today, a Masjid al-Nabawi Sharif. And the Prophet's father was buried in one of his uncle's houses. And it is towards Babu Salam, as we go towards the famous mosques, Masjid al-Aqsa, Masjid al-Ali, Masjid al-Omar, Masjid al-Abu Bakr. But it was at a very short distance as you step out today from Babu Salam, walking towards outside a couple of steps, and he was buried in that very location of that house. And that house used to have a well. Allah radiallahu anhu, the father of the Prophet, was buried in this location, this particular house. It was bricked up, and it was there under the Ottoman. It was still intact. Took over, 1924, 1925. Prior to this, let's talk about what atrocities they claimed in Karbala, in Najaf. They bulldozed everything there before they came to Al-Hijaz. And then started demolishing Baqi, Al-Fa'la, and so forth. Demolished this particular house where the Prophet's father was buried. And then not only what they did, they exhumed his body. Mm-hmm. And I have many witnesses to see this, and we have a video recording of this lying around somewhere with one of our colleagues. In those days, it was not sophisticated technology. It was made on a handmade reel projector. And when they exhumed his blessed body, it was as if he was performed with a shroud and ghusl and washed his blessed body today. It was still dripping water, and you could still smell his beautiful fragrance from his blessed body. And then they put him in General Baqi, without marking the exact location where their blessed body was buried. We know that he's buried slightly behind the blessed grave of Sayyida Fatima of the Al-Arda. So why do we just ignore these atrocities? Why do we just say, well, I'm sorry, it's happened, and we can't do anything about it? What is dangerous is not it has happened. The dangerous thing is what they've caused the Muslim Ummah to feel like go to Ta'ban or relax and say, well, we don't have the authority, we don't have the power. The frightening thing is what is to come. And I will talk about it as we go along, what has happened over several years. As you see at those people who have visited Mecca now, you see this ugly clock tower overlooking the Kaaba.
Exactly.
And this is not Mecca. I don't literally mean it's not Mecca, but in a metaphorical way, it's Meccahattan.
Exactly.
I give example of the Vatican in Rome. Vatican is protected by the sacred law of Rome, that you are not allowed to build any building skyscrapers over and around the particular radius of the Vatican.
Correct.
You're not even allowed to build anything around the White House in Washington. You're not allowed to build anything overlooking the Big Ben in London. But Mecca and Mukarrama is not any land. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala mentions it in the Quran, and he swears by the blessed city. It is a sacred land. It's a sacred sanctuary where you are not allowed to pluck a tree. You're not allowed to kill a bird, insects. As a matter of fact, hunting is forbidden when you are in the sacred sanctuary.
Exactly.
When someone has committed a crime and he enters the hudud, the boundary of the Haram,
yes,
Sharif, you're not allowed to kill that person. You may arrest that person, but you are not allowed to kill him or her. And here we see Mecca being dynamited, you know. And you know, the sad fact is the four mountains which surround the Kaaba, Jabal Abu Qabais, Jabal Kaaba, Jabal Umar, Kokanan, these are mentioned in the Quran. And people, the Muslims, really need to get to their heritage, understand what the Quran is talking. It's a beautiful book. It's a beautiful religion. And the Quran says that Allah placed the stakes of this of these mountains into the earth to create a mizan, to balance the earth, so yes, it does not imbalance. And the science have realized now, and the books are available, the center point of the universe, no matter where you measure it, from Iran, from Africa, from the subcontinent, from America, the center of the universe is the Kaaba. Now, if these mountains which Allah placed on the earth to stabilize the earth with the mizan as the balance, and then the Al Saud, they placed dynamites over them to blow them up, to build these ugly skyscrapers, and then their towering palaces, what happens is we have turbulations around the world. What do we have? Tsunamis. We have earthquakes. And the reason, it's, of course, it's natural, but people don't understand the reason why it's happening, because the mizan, the balance which was placed by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, has been disturbed. And this causes the imbalance for the tsunamis to occur, earthquakes to take progress. And I give you an example. Jabal al-Umar is a mountain which has been there for centuries. It has been demolished, and the frightening thing was this mountain, every day they would come up with dynamites there to pull the latest hotels there. And then when they'd come in the morning, the Bin Laden Construction Company, they realized the rocks have come back again as a miracle. They couldn't believe it. Where the hell does these rocks come back again? So they'll try it again, and it'll happen again. Anyway, they continued with this until they completely raised this mountain, and you have ugly hotels standing there.
Dr. Al-Alawi, so let me go back to what you mentioned, which is that, let's try to analyze this a little deeper, which is you said that the vast majority of the Muslims are quiet about this issue, and we can say that maybe they are scared of the Al-Saud. Of course, the Shias, because they have their issues with the Al-Saud, are the ones that talk about it because of the closeness that they have with the Ahlul Bayt and the family of the Prophet. Maybe they are a little bit more inclined to mention these issues. But would you say that the reason that the majority of the Muslims are not talking about these things is, one, on the one hand, ignorance of these issues, and secondly, because they are actually a little bit scared of the Al Saud and the money and the power and the influence that they have in the Ummah? Is this a correct analysis of what's happening here?
Well, let me explain. The Muslims are ignorant of the fact of what has been happening in Hijaz. And yes, the other issue is petrodollars. Petrodollars plays a significant influence on the Muslims. And the example here is in around the world where the Muslim countries, so-called Muslim leaders, i.e. in Pakistan, Morocco, Egypt, these leaders, they have heritage in their country. Egypt has significant Ahlul Bayt shrines there. Imam Shafi, Imam Hussein, Sayyidah Zainab, Sayyidah Nafisat al-Ulum, I can go on. Great Sufi shrine, Sheikh Salih al-Jafri, Sheikh Ibrahim Tasuki, and so forth. The question is that why are Muslims frightened? The reason why they're frightened is because the average Muslim thinks that they will be banned of visiting Hijaz,
right,
to perform the lesser pilgrimage or Hajj.
Correct.
The other issue here is the because these countries that I've mentioned are poor countries, and the economy is relying on foreign funds, especially Al Saud, and hence these leaders will not speak about the atrocities Al Saud has committed. But that should not stop the Muslims living in these countries to convince and a wake up call to say, hold on, enough is enough. Because look, I mean, I'll give you an example here, since we brought Egypt up. The pyramids in Egypt have been up there for more than 8,000 years. perhaps even more. And the Prophet ﷺ passed away 1,400 plus years ago. Now, they have been up there at the time of the Prophet ﷺ. Where did the Prophet say, go and demolish the pyramids because they're pharaonic? Or the Bamiyan idols in Afghanistan, where did he say, go and demolish them? Islam does not say you got demolished and wipe his history. Islam says you learn by its previous mistakes and errors, but you don't demolish them.
Exactly.
So this machinery, I call it the even machinery of the Wahhabis and of Al Saud and Al Sheikh, it is so evil that it's penetrated in many countries in the world and with their patrol influences and started changing the beliefs of many Muslims, and they think and they realize that perhaps their forefathers who have been praising and visiting these heritage sites have, as a matter of fact, committed bid'ah and dalala and shirk.
Great. So, Doctor, let me stay on this a little bit, and then we can go back maybe mentioning some more examples, because I think that's good for us to mention for the viewers, you know, the facts, because these are such amazing facts that maybe some are not familiar with it. But before we get to that, it seems to me that there's a connection between the ignorance of the Wahhabi, you know, bid'ah, the Wahhabi ignorance, and the way that the West, the Americans, and the Zionists are weaponizing this. So it kind of fits very well together. On the one hand, you have these Wahhabis who basically took over Hejaz in the 1930s and began this destruction, although the previous Saudi states had done similar things in previous centuries. But at the same time, this allows the enemies of Islam, the Zionists and some of the Western countries, to literally erase Islamic history, and with that, any sort of a deeper, real understanding of Islam that would be then used for Muslims to liberate themselves, to be able to manage their own affairs, to manage their own ummah, and to repel this onslaught that's been coming from the West in the last 200 years. So do you think that there's a connection, that it's not just simply, I mean, that the one element of the Wahhabi ignorance is one element of it, but it is being instrumentalized, weaponized by those countries in order to get the Al Saud to be the head of the spear in a way for destroying real Islam and the knowledge of Muslims about what real Islam is?
Yes, there is some connection by the Zionist regime, and no doubt they've been penetrating there for a very long time. And we must not forget the Al Saud was put up there by the British to get rid of King Hussein and the Ottoman Empire. You know, one of the sheikhs have said, Al-Yahud, Al-Saud. These go together, Yahud right. and Saud. They are part of the same parcel. I'll give you an example. In the Kaaba, as we look at the Bab al-Kaaba, the door of the Kaaba, and how the Zionists have moved in penetrating this, is the Kaaba itself has the names engraved on of King Abdulaziz and so forth. And some people don't even realize what is engraved. They think it's the Kalam or the Quran engraved of them, even on the Kiswa, the on the Kaaba.
Right. The cloth, here, that's is, the cloth that's yes, thrown over there. Yes.
That which is draped over the Kaaba.
Right.
It does not have everything which is the words of Allah of the Quran. It has many calligraphy which is praising King Abdulaziz mm-hmm. and the current king and so forth. But let's talk about the door itself, other than the name of the king. There are some symbols. If you look at the zoom at any of the images, or if you have the opportunity to visit the Kaaba, you'll go and you see the sun symbols on the door of the Kaaba. Now, those sun symbols, there are lines in between reflecting the rays of the sun. There are about seven lines between. When we look at these symbols, I was in Syria several years ago, and I was sitting with one of a historian, a friend of mine, and who is an expert on some heritage and some symbols. And suddenly I started this conversation of the sun symbols, which I found on the door of the Kaaba, and he was taken back. I was quite shocked. He said, are you sure? And I showed him the image that I had. He said, okay, just wait here Irfan, let's meet here over coffee and discuss it tomorrow. I want to make sure that I'm going to tell you something which will shock you. He came back the next day and he found that these symbols are with the Masonic symbols related to the Zoroastrianism, which was practiced centuries ago. And